Okay, so today we have lecture 14, and the topic is nonlinear spectroscopy and bump probe spectroscopy. And here we go. Yes. Okay, so here we follow Kelly book chapter 9, and so the pump probe spectroscopy, nonlinear spectroscopy are related. So pump probe spectroscopies we do with the short pulses, laser pulses, and when we have short laser pulses, in particular femtosecond laser pulses, intensities grow extremely high. So peak intensity is very high, and then what often happens are nonlinear effects. That means basically that we have multiple photon processes, not just single photon at the time interacts with the molecule, but two or more photons interact at the same time, and then we enter the region of nonlinear spectroscopy. So simply it means that when we do normal spectroscopies like fluorescence, Raman, infrared, so we have a bunch of photons hitting the sample, and normally processes occur one photon at a time. So one absorption, one photon is absorbed, one photon is emitted. But in nonlinear range, when intensities are very high, we have a lot of photons, then it can happen that two photons interact at the same time with the molecule. And then that is basically a region of nonlinear spectroscopy. So, and from the theoretical point of view, one should use higher order perturbation theory, not the first order, which is used to derive equations for linear spectroscopies. The key point is that the signals depend on higher powers of intensity. So, for example, the signal can depend on second power of intensity or third power. Okay. Simply thinking, optical processes can be considered as resulting from material or molecular polarization. And the idea is that if you think classically that when we have oscillating electric field, that oscillating electric field induces oscillating polarization in the matter. For example, in the molecule, oscillating dipole moment. And that oscillating dipole moment will emit radiation. So this is the linear process. But more generally, here we have an equation for polarization or dipole moment. And polarization is a same as dipole moment, but for material. So if we have dipole moment for one molecule, polarization is for matter. About matter. So we have material polarization, and that can emit radiation. And generally, we can describe it in this way. For example, the polarization is coefficient, first order coefficient, this is susceptibility, linear susceptibility, times electric field. So this term is responsible for linear effect. So we induce oscillating polarization, and that emits radiation. But then we have other terms. The second term has a chi 2, so second order susceptibility times electric field to the second power. So this is the first nonlinear term. And normally this chi 2 is much, much smaller than chi 1. So this term is very small. But when electric field grows higher and higher, this term grows much faster than the linear term. And at some point, this term starts to be important. So we start to observe nonlinear effects. Then we can have a third order effect, pi 3, and then electric field to the third power, and so on. So, and of course, this is still more smaller, this pi 3, but when we have e to the third power, it grows so fast that at very high intensities, these effects start to play a role. And we can write the same for dipole moment here. So we have a static dipole moment times plus the first term polarizability times E, which we encountered in Raman. But then we have the second polarizability, beta times E squared, and gamma is to the third power, and so on. So the idea is that these coefficients are very small. So under normal light conditions, these terms are very, very small. But when the intensity grows, they grow in, and then these effects become observable. Well, this simple example of a nonlinear effect is multiphoton absorption. And it is a process like this. So we have initial state, and we have some final state, and we can have other states. But the idea is that if I use photon energy, which is way below the energy for direct absorption to any of the states. So if I irradiate the sample with this omega Fi per 2 photons, certainly there will be no absorption. But if I increase intensity, increase and increase, at some point, a process may occur where two photons are absorbed simultaneously. And then I reach this final state with the two photon absorption. And this is coherent process. So it occurs without any relaxation process in between. So not like one photon absorbed and then comes second photon and then that is observed. This occurs simultaneously. So two photons drive the system to the final state. So that is a multiphoton absorption. And this is a two photon absorption. But there can be three photon absorption, four, five, six. If you use very high intensities, you can have like six or seven photon absorption. So it's a very high order process. This can occur. And so really there's a distinction. If you absorb one photon, maybe molecule performs some relaxation, and then you absorb a second photon, this is not two photon absorber, it's sequential one photon absorber. But this, what we mean here is a simultaneous absorption, two photons. Well, the theory for the two photon absorption actually looks very similar to Raman, because basically Raman is also a two photon process, but it occurs one photon and basically excitation by one photon and then emission of a second photon. But this is absorption of two photons. And this is a rate for two photon absorption. And the first we have a constant intensity second to the second power. So this is important. So this is a second order effect, nonlinear. So it's proportional to the intensity squared. Then we have a bunch of constants and the density of states. But then in this bracket, we have the bracket square term, and there we have the mu terms. These are the matrix elements, transition dipoles, mu fv. So that is the final state and v state. And then we have e terms. These are the vector, unit vectors. These are polarization effects. But so in principle, it is a dot product of two transition dipoles, where we start from initial state, go to the intermediate state V, and then from V to final state. So similarly to Raman, we have product of two matrix elements. And then we have the, in a denominator, the resonance effect. So basically, the omega is our used frequency, and whether these transitions are resonant, if they are resonant, the terms will be very high. If they are not resonant, we have a bunch of small terms, and the sum goes over all possible V states, all possible intermediate states. So this is similar effect that we basically consider process where first photon kind of brings the system to virtual V state, and from V state we go to final state. But in reality, they happen coherently, but both these matrix elements are important. So it's from theoretical point of view, we have to sum over many, 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 many terms in order to get the final result. So that's the difference to the linear processor. For the linear process, we have only one matrix element. These few states. Here we have sum of all possible V intermediate V states. Well, so that is a theory, theoretical point of view. So of course, if you perform a calculation, quantum chemical calculation, where you can calculate these matrix elements, then you can do this calculation and you can get the number. You can calculate the rate. But from experimental point of view, we can describe this efficiency for two photon process. We can describe it with the two photon absorption cross section. And we have not discussed actually too much about the cross section, but so the cross section is equivalent to molar absorption coefficient. It is, but the molar absorption coefficient is a coefficient for a mole of molecule, but cross section is equivalent quantity for one molecule. So what is a cross section of one molecule? That describes the efficiency of absorption. And now we can describe this process with the two photon absorption cross section. And I will go through both cases, the linear case and two photon case, to see how this goes. So this is an equivalent procedure how we derive molar absorption coefficient, or now we do it for linear absorption cross section. So we consider a light beam traveling through absorbing medium, and then n is the number density of absorbers. So how many molecules per cubic centimeter, for example, so equivalent to concentration. And now we have a differential. So basically, attenuation of intensity of the light beam as a function of coordinate z. So this is the optical path. And that is proportional to intensity and proportional to the cross section and proportional to the concentration or number density of molecules. So the logic is that certainly this makes sense. Of course, cross section describes the, how strongly molecules absorb light. Number density, of course, more molecules we have, the more absorption, and intensity itself or change in intensity is proportional to the intensity itself. So this is a differential equation. We rearrange. So we take the intensity to the left and the dz to the right. And that gives us this equation where we have intensity on the left and not on the right. So this is just rearranging. And now we can integrate both sides. So we integrate left side, we integrate right side. And that leads us to this equation. So this is exponential attenuation of the light beam. And this is basically exactly the same as what we have for the molar absorption coefficient. Because you can see it if I rearrange this. So we have intensity is initial intensity times exponential minus sigma n l. So this is when the light comes to the absorbing medium, intensity decays exponential, right? And now if I take I zero, it is e to the minus sigma n l. Now, if I take minus ln on both sides, I have minus ln I zero is sigma n l. And now we have natural logarithm. But if I would replace this with 10 base logarithm, which we have a relation, it would be, you can recognize that this is absorbance. This is transmittance, and minus logarithm is absorbance. Is cross-section times number density times L. And you can remember from molar absorption coefficient that absorbance is same as molar absorption coefficient times concentration. So this is how it is derived, this equation. And the only difference here is that now we use cross-section. So this is a property of the molecule. Cross-section, and as we can see, it is in reality, we should have a natural logarithm. And 10-base logarithm is used because traditionally it was much easier to handle 10-base logarithm than natural logarithm. Nowadays, it wouldn't make a difference. Okay, so similarly, we can define two-photon cross-section. So if we write the exactly same equation, so at the change in the intensity of the beam with respect to change in the optical path, Z. Now, exactly the same, except that now we have intensity squared. Because this is a nonlinear process. So I to the second power. Okay, and we rearrange again. Exactly same, except we have I to the second power in the denominator. And then we integrate. And you can integrate both sides. And here's the procedure. And this is the result. So that is a intensity. Now, in terms of L. And this is expression. And it behaves a bit differently than exponential attenuation. Two-photon process is a funny thing. So because attenuation depends on the square of the intensity. If you have a strong beam, it is quickly attenuated. But as it attenuates, attenuation decreases. So it's quickly then, unfortunately, I didn't plot this, but it is more like, so it would attenuate fast, but then it would, attenuation would become very slow, because when the intensity decreases, the attenuation gets much slower. So, and for example, this effect is used in safety goggles for fighter pilots. So, you know, if there is like a nuclear explosion, there's a huge a pulse of light, and you have to cover your eyes from it. So it is important to be able to attenuate this high intensity light, but still see through otherwise. So this is completely transparent for low intensity light, but for high intensity light, it attenuates. So this kind of effect can be used if you have a good two-photon absorber. You can make a transparent mask, which, however, can cover from a strong intensity radius, also from laser radius. So that is very useful. Okay, so we can consider units a bit, because intensity usually is given in terms of photons per area per second. It could be given as joules per second per area, but if we use photons per area per second, that is often used, and then N is typically used in units of molecules per volume. For example, molecules per cubic centimeter. And then the unit for the cross section, because this has to be dimensionless, and when we use intensity and length and N, then the unit for the cross section becomes, okay, area squared, photons per second to the minus one, and molecule minus one. And for example, it can be centimeters to fourth power times second per photon. So it's a very funny looking unit. So this is a unit for two photon absorption cross section. And it comes from this, when you plug it in here, and you plug in intensity and number density and length, then you get the dimension. It's also a convention that 10 to minus 50 units is equal to 1 GM. according to Maria Göpfert-Meyer. So this is a commonly used unit, GM for Pivotal cross section, just for you to know. So it's 10 to minus 50. So the values are very small. So we are talking about something like 10 to minus 50. That's the order of magnitude. So they look very, very small. But when you put intensity squared, it becomes very large. So it will make sense. Then, of course, if you have free photon absorption, the unit again is something like 10 to minus 75 or something like that. So very, very small values. Okay, and you can, if you like, you can do the same for free photon absorption cross-section. Just put the I to the third power and do the integrate. You will get, of course, at the higher order process, the steeper will be initial attenuator. Then it levels off fast. Okay. Also, from this two photon absorption, when we have a dot product of two molecular transition dipole moments and both have the polarization vectors, the symmetries for two photon absorption operator are binary products xx, yy, zz, xy, and so on. So they are same for, as in Raman. So when we're talking about symmetry selection rules, then for two photon cross absorption, we have to look in a character tables these binary terms. So they give the selection rules. Also, if we have a center of symmetry, GG and UU transition are allowed and others not. So we have to consider symmetry selection rules, and for two photon absorption, they are different than for one photon absorption. And really, of course, you can't do this kind of experiments with normal spectrometers, but if you use high intensity light, like femtosecond pulse, you can easily generate. So if you do femtosecond experiment, actually you have to always check if you are inducing two photon processes, because they occur very commonly. And of course, you can do it free or more photon absorption, no problem. Okay, so that was a kind of an example of a multiphoton process, nonlinear optical process. Now, let's consider pump probe spectroscopy. So this is also a technique that where we use pulsed high intensity lasers. The idea is fairly simple. So we have two laser beams, two pulse laser beams. So we have two pulses. And we have a sample. And we measure from the sample the transmittance. So basically, it's kind of a similar to absorption experiments. We pass the beam, which we call probe. So that probes the sample, pass it through the sample, and we measure the attenuation of the beam. So we measure the intensity before and after, similarly to normal absorption experiments. But the new feature is that now we use a second beam or pulse, which we call pump. And that pump is used to pump the system from equilibrium ground state to some excited state. So we put population into excited state. And that means that the absorption properties change. So certainly when we excite, and this is intense, the pump beam is intense, it's strong. It pumps a lot of molecules into excited state. And when these are pulsed, we can trigger the reaction or the process with the pump pulse. So we come in with a very short flash of light, and it changes the populations of ground and excited states. And of course, they start to evolve. Relaxation process happens. So energy will flow, molecule will go from between different states, there is vibrational energy flow, and so on. And the probe pulse is exactly timed with respect to pump into the same volume. So we need accurate steering of the beams because they are focused, and we go to small volume, but we overlap them. And then we follow, and then we come in with the pump, we put a little bit delay, come with the probe and measure what happens. Then we change the delay. So we increase the delay by one step and we repeat. The idea here is that the sample has to be such that we can repeat the same process. So one pulse comes in, initiates the process, we measure, and then everything relaxes to the ground state back. A second pulse comes, we change the delay and we measure. And now we change the delay sequentially and measure again and again and again. And we try to, then we interpret what happens in the sample. So we get the time trace. And the time resolution is typically on the order of 100 femtoseconds. It can be better, it can be tens of femtoseconds. For example, with our system, we can reach 30 femtosecond time resolution. So that means that with this time resolution, we can investigate what happens in the sample. And that in that time scale, this is a time scale for motion of nuclei, for example, in vibrational motion. So in principle, we can see the motion of nuclei with this method. And certainly we can see vibrational relaxation time, which occurs in picoseconds. We can observe ultra-fast changes of electronic states, internal conversion, in-system crossing. So that is a technique to investigate the ultra-fast dynamics of molecules. Nowadays, with special techniques, you can go to higher time resolution. So people are working in the attosecond region, so that's 10 to minus 18 seconds, so below one femtosecond. So then new phenomena appear. You can follow electron dynamics, but that is a different story. Okay, so basically, in practice, what is done is to perform two measurements. You always need a reference measurement. A reference measurement means that we measure this in the absence of pump. So we don't put the pump and we measure the transmittance, and then we put the pump in and we measure again. So we get accurately a difference. And that is described here. So delta T, the change in transmission, is basically now we call signal the measurement with pump on and reference measurement without pump. So we do the transmission with the pump on and we minus transmission without pump. So that is a reference. And then we divide by reference. So that is a delta T change in transmission. And absorption we get when we take a logarithm of transmission. I just remind you that transmission is a ratio of incident intensity divided by transmitted intensity. No pump present, then it's reference, and signal if pump is present. So basically, doing normal absorption measurement, but in a pulsed mode and with and without reference. In practice, we can use broad band probe, which means that it is spectrally broad. And there are different techniques for that. But anyway, we can have a broad spectrum, and then we can disperse in a grating this spectrum, and we can measure actually whole spectrum at once, because we can then detect this on a CCD camera. So not just one wavelength, but whole spectrum at once. So that is very good. Okay, now a little bit of theoretical development. So if we have two states, ground and excited, and the pump and probe pulses are well separated in time, this condition is put there because when they overlap in time, non-linear optical effects occur, and this is not easy to interpret what happens there. So that's why we kind of assume that there is a little bit of, so they are not overlaps in time. And then in this condition, the fraction of molecules excited to the upper state by a pulse. Okay, so this is the pump pulse. So we have NE, so excited state molecules, number of excited molecules divided by ground state molecules. proportional to this expression, we have sigma. So that is a cross section and divided by h bar omega. And then we have integral and integral over tau, which is time and intensity. So that means basically that we integrate over the whole pulse. So basically, excited state population is proportional to the integrated intensity of the pump pulse and to the cross section. That makes sense because, of course, the total number of photons counts what we have in a pulse. That's why we integrate over the pulse. And then we get the full intensity, basically all full number of photons times the cross section. So that is the excited state population is proportional to that. And now there is a little bit of explanation about this when the pulse is overlapping time. So that is a situation when nonlinear effects take place. We don't go to that. But otherwise, so what we are aiming at is to follow kinetics of different excited states. What happens? Of course, in the beginning, we get depletion of the ground state. We can see that. And we get population of the excited state, but then they depopulate, there's a relaxation. This is what we want to follow. And we can have multiple species, not just one, but we can we can model this by assuming that we have many species, J, and we can consider a possibility of multiple species. And now, so we can write for the intensity of the probe pulse. So now we are interested in modeling how we, what processes affect the probe pulse intensity. This is what we measure for transmittance of the probe pulse. And we consider DI, so what happens? How does it change? Now as a function of omega and B, so basically spectrally and temporally resolved. And that is something which is here. So it basically looks complicated, but it's not. So basically, it's proportional to these W terms, JK minus WKJ. Okay, so what does that mean? So the first, it's a rate of transitions per unit volume, and the JK is rate for processes from J to K. Okay, so we have two possible states. And that term describes spontaneous and stimulated emission, because that is a positive term. So if we have spontaneous emission, then this increases, it's positive. Or stimulated emission, we get more radiation, so it's positive. And then we have the negative term, and that is the rate of transition per volume from K to J, and that is absorption. So if there is absorption process, of course, we deplete photons, and that is negative term. So intensity decreases. And in the next expression, we just write these in terms of Einstein coefficients. So basically, so we have in for the rate, we have N, so the population of J state, and that is time dependent, times the Einstein coefficient JK, and then the radiation density of states. This is something we encountered on the first lecture, but this time we just use it for this temporal process. So that is a stimulated emission term. And next term is a spontaneous emission term. So we have an Einstein coefficient A, and then we have the minus term, we have absorption term, where we have Einstein coefficient again. So this is just writing these in terms of Einstein coefficient. And, but it is important now to realize that this is normally when we do absorption measurement, we don't care about stimulated emission. That is extremely small contribution. But when we do this pump probe, we have to remember that stimulated emission actually can be rather strong because we can pump a lot of population upstairs. And then even when the system evolves, for some spectral range, there can be even population inversion. So stimulated emission is definitely not non-negligible. It's a strong term. So that has to be kept along. But spontaneous emission definitely makes a negligible contribution. because the rate for spontaneous emission is very, very small compared to the stimulated emission and the time scales. We are measuring in femtosecond time scale. So we neglect the spontaneous emission. So this is the same equation now, just neglecting the spontaneous emission. So basically, here now the point is that it is the stimulated emission minus absorption. So we have to consider both. Those are the competing terms. And here we have rearranged a bit so that for the radiation density of states, we use expression, which involves intensity. Then we have m per c times density of states. This is also something from the first lecture. So because of that, we get intensity in front of these sigmas, and we have just the raw density of states expression. And now, for the Einstein coefficient times rho, we can use expression where we have the cross section. And then we can rewrite and now put this into form of differential equation. So di per I, so that is something we use to extract the cross section expression. And now we have simply just see that we have population of J state minus population at K state, and that population difference times cross section for the transition. Because you see that transition KJ, the Einstein coefficient is the same for stimulated emission and absorption. So it's just the population difference which determines, which is what we see. And now the states go over all possible different states. And now we integrate, so we have dz again, do the same thing as we did just a few slides ago. And this is the what we get. Similar expression as with just cross sections, but now we have intensity. So transmittance basically IL divided by I0. So initial intensity downstairs and after the sample intensity upstairs. So transmittance is exponent, and then in the exponent we have this population difference times cross section times L. So the difference here to the what we derived before was that instead of population we have, or concentration, we have population difference, right? And but of course we can have multiple species, so we have sums over J and K. So the total transmittance depends on all populations on different states, and of course the cross sections. And then the task is to try to figure out from the how the spectrum evolves, how many species we have. So it can be quite complicated if you have multiple species, but that is how it is. So I will show you an example from our own work. So this is again gold nanocluster example. So this time it is gold 144. So we have 144 gold atoms in the core, and we have 60 phenyl ethyl ligands. So you can see how the ligand looks like. So it's a benzene ring and 2C2 group. And we are interested here on the question, what happens when we excite electronically the core? And the low energy excitations in the visible range are localized in the metal core. So we are interested in seeing what happens after excitation. How does the energy flow from this initially excited state to the ligand layer and then further to the solvent? And in fact, I show you the result here, but I show also data how this was obtained. And our result was that with a time constant in a 1.5 picosecond, you have electron-electron scattering, electron-photon scattering, vibrational excitation. What does it mean? It means that we first hit excite electronically the core, and there are lots of states. And what happens? So this is on the edge of being a metallic system. So there is the excited electron is scattered from other electron states. So we have kind of electron-electron scattering processes, which distribute energy among different electronic states. We have electron-photon scattering. That means that electron excitation excites vibrational motion. Phonons are lattice vibrations. So then we have phonon excitation and vibrational excitation of a ligand layer as well, at least in the interface. So in a very rapid time scale, the electronic energy is converted to phonon excitation. But, and then with a time scale of 29 picoseconds, heat dissipates into the surroundings. So then from the core, we excite the ligand molecules, and then with the 29 picosecond time scale, this heat is dissipated to the solvent. So that means that roughly, so if 29 picoseconds is time constant, it means that roughly after 100 picoseconds of the initial excitation, system has returned to the ground state, and the excitation energy has gone to the solvent as a heat. This is the experiment. I will explain. So this is now exactly in such a way that we have probe pass, which is dispersed, and the spectrum is measured. Now, the key point here is that our probe is in the infrared range. So you see, this is wave number, 1510 to 1407. So this is in infrared range. And we have visible pump pulse. And what I'm plotting here is a spectrum, part of the infrared spectrum, actually quite narrow part, as a function of time. So here is our excitation hitting the sample. And what we, if nothing happens, this will be all flat. But when we excite, there is a population difference generated, and we can see the blue part, it is negative. So we get negative contribution, bleach to the spectrum at this point. This is a particular vibrational band, which is depleted. So we deplete population. And the red is positive, so we generate absorption, net absorption here at closely. And then we see how it evolves. So this slowly returns to the ground state, and after 75 picoseconds, it has returned back. And same here, it has returned back. This is a vibrational band, and the depletion means that it's vibrationally excited. And that part of the spectrum means that it is shifted. The absorption is shifted, so we generate by absorption here, and it is shifted because the system is heated. So if you take a vibrational band and you heat your system, it will be shifted. And we see this heating as a shift, which is shown up as a negative bleach and positive band. And you can see that the positive band gets narrower in time. So when the system cools down, the shift gets smaller, and this positive band gets narrower, and finally they disappear. So from here we can, this is a thermometer. We can follow the temperature of the molecule as a function of time. But additionally, we have initial very broad absorption, very short-lived. You see, well, this is a broad absorption, and it comes and goes very fast. That is electronic absorption. And here is a cross-section. So if you take a cross-section along certain spectral component, this is the bleach. You see, it quickly developed, and then it returns exponential with the exponential behavior. And then we have the transient absorption. First fast peak, and that goes away quickly. And then we have the exponential decay. And finally, everything has returned back within about 100 picoseconds. And here is another spectral component where we don't have this vibrational long-term component, but just the short component. You see that this is very rapid growth, this electronic characteristics of the gold core. So from this kind of experiment, pump probe experiment, we can get a detailed understanding of photophysics, what happened, how the energy relaxes from electronic states to the phonons and then further to the surrounding. So it forms a quite detailed picture of what is the relaxation dynamics for such a system. And this is very interesting information. First of all, this tells us that the system is in a metallic state. Because if you have this is an important question for the small gold metal clusters. If I take a bulk metal, I have no energy gap. So that means that there are no long-lived states. If you excite electron, it will very rapidly come down and relax. But if I take a small cluster, it's not metallic, but molecular. So we have an energy gap. And when we have the energy gap, if I excite the system, it will go quickly to the bottom, just like a molecule. And then there will be a long-lived state. And the question here, the electronic relaxation occurs extremely rapidly within about 1.5 picoseconds, and there is no long-lived state. That tells us that there is no significant energy gap. But we also probe the metallicity of the gold plasma. And we performed a similar experiment for gold 102. And for gold 102, we do see long-lived state with about nanosecond time scale. So that tells us that from gold 102 to gold 144, the system changes from molecular to metallic state. So we can get a great deal of information about the nature of the clusters. And yes.
Question about the blue one. What is the possible for stars to act together?
Here. Well, I think that's a good question. I am not sure. I think it has to do with this rapid component, this speak, that if we would do this picking at the point where there is no rapid component, it would not go there. I think it's a picking issue that this very broad peak affects the picking so that it generates this. I think it's not real. I think it's a problem from this picking. I think, I'm not sure, but I think so. This is remarkably good fit otherwise. So you can see that they very nicely follow this exponential behavior. So it's a good fit. And also from this information, we were able to calculate how much the cluster heats up, what is the temperature? Because this is an interesting question, because this kind of not small clusters, but larger particles are used for so-called photodynamic therapy. So if you can tag these clusters with the surface molecules, which make them bound to, for example, tumor, cancer tumor, and then you can irradiate with the light, which absorbs, you can heat up the clusters and they can destroy the tumor. And this information led us to estimate the temperature. So it's interesting. And it led us estimate how much intensity we have to use to reach a certain temperature. So it's quite fundamental work, but it gives very important information for applications as well. Okay, so that is a pump probe method, very generally used. We have several pump probe setups here. And so in principle, it is very generally used technique. Whenever you have some kind of absorbing state, as you always have, you can use this technique. Now, it's possible to observe more detailed nuclear motion. Now, I saw a few slides about that. It happens that if the laser pulses are very short, if they are shorter than the vibrational period, so that during the excitation, molecule doesn't go even one vibration. What has can be done is that you can excite so-called vibrational wave packets. You can excite coherently two or more vibrational states with the same power. And that creates a vibrational wave packet. So it means that it is a localized state, which is in this picture is described by this solid line on the upper state. And that vibrational wave packet moves. And it starts to move back and forth. It moves from this end of the potential to the other, and then it bounces back and forth. So the motion of vibrational wave packets resembles classical motion, classical vibrational motion. So far we have been discussing vibrational states, and we can make transitions to vibrational states. But if we make a excite two vibrational states simultaneously, coherently, it makes a vibrational wave packet, not stationary state, which moves. So vibrational wave packet starts to move back and forth. And in this kind of experiment, where we use one photon to excite vibrational wave packet, and then a second photon, here either the small arrow or large arrow, that second photon can excite the system to a second excited state. And if we observe this second excited state absorption, you can see that if the wave packet is right here, and we use this probe with a small arrow, it will excite the system to second excited state. But if the wave packet moves to the left, we need different resonant excitation to reach the excited state. So it means that if I tune my probe light wavelength to here, to the dark arrow, I will see absorption immediately after excitation of wave packet, but then absorption will go to zero because my wave packet goes out. Then if I tune the delay so that wave packet comes back, again, I will see absorption. And then it means I will see oscillations in the absorption. And these oscillations correspond to vibrational motion, nuclear motion. So that is the principle of observing vibrational wave packets. There is also a second way to induce vibrational wave packets on a ground electronic state with a Raman, imparting Raman scattering. So you can take two photons. Basically, you can drive Raman scattering process, one photon up, second down. If you tune, for example, your second laser beam to the, so that it is it corresponds to Stokes transition, you can drive wave packet, vibrational wave packet on the ground electrons, and the same thing can happen. And then with the third pulse, you can probe this ground vibration state wave packet. Okay. And well, this is a formal treatment. If we generate a wave packet, wave function, it's a linear combination of two vibration states. Psi zero, psi one, and that is a wave packet. Okay. Now, you can write the time dependence for the wave packet in this way. You can put into these basis states psi zero, psi one, an exponential factor with the time. And well, we have not gone through this time dependent quantum mechanics, so let's not stick to that, but anyway, you can calculate this. You can calculate the what is the wave function as a function of time. Let's not go into detail. And now we can calculate the expectation value of the vibration coordinate. So you just now we take this time dependent wave function and sandwich Q for the coordinate operator between them, and we can actually calculate that. And don't worry about the details, but the result is a cosine term with the vibrational frequency. So this shows that also from a theoretical point of view, that this vibrational coordinate oscillates just like classical motion. Now, and because the system samples different parts of the potential energy curve, then that gives a basis for observing this motion via spectral measurements. And here is an example from our own work again. It looks very complicated. experiment. It's a little bit complicated, but this is a nonlinear process. Again, it involves multiple photons. This is so-called time-dependent coherent anti-Stokes Raman scattering. The system is simple. It's an ideal molecule complex with a xenon atom. The process is like this. We start from the ground state. We make a resonant excitation, but right away with the second photon, we pump back to the ground electron state and form a vibrational wave back on the ground electron state. So the vibrational wave back, it starts to go back and forth. And now we come in with the third photon, and that is the orange photon. And third photon brings the system up to the excited state again. And from the excited state, it emits or scatters a photon back to the ground state. And we measure this fourth scattered photon intensity as a function of time delay between pulses 2 and 3. So pulses 1 and 2 come simultaneously. So first two pulses drive the system immediately to the vibrational wave packet of the ground electron state. Then we adjust the delay to the third pulse and observe intensity of the scattered photon. So that allows us to observe wave packets on the ground electron state. So here is again what I just said in words. And here's a result. This is a low temperature rare gas matrix, crystal of a rare gas where we have embedded iodine molecules and complex xenon atoms. And the overall signal, this signal is now the intensity of the scattered fourth photon as a function of time delay between pulses 2 and 3. And here is the overall thing, how it looks like. And you can see oscillation and decay, exponential decay. But in fact, this is not the primary oscillation, but if I magnify, here is the primary oscillation. You can see beautiful, beautiful spikes. So these spikes are the motion of the vibrational wave packet. And why we have this secondary oscillation is that we have a three component wave packet. So we have three vibrational states. So what happens? We have beating between two states, and that gives us this oscillation. And we have beating between two other states, which gives us similar oscillation, but with slightly different frequency. So what happens is that they are first in phase, but in time they go out of phase, so the total amplitude gets smaller, and then they come into phase again, so it goes higher. So this is like a, you know, if you play guitar, you have two strings. If they are tuned slightly off, you will see a beating. So this is exactly the same. So we have this. This is a beating of two oscillators, which are slightly different. And this is the beating of the individual ones. So we can really, really, really beautifully observe vibrational wave packet motion, all the tens of picoseconds. So we can see, observe tens and hundreds of beatings. So it shows that it's coherent over a very long time. So it's very nice. In fact, if you perform Fourier transform, you can get the frequencies. So this is a frequency spectrum which you obtain by Fourier transforming this one. So from this time domain spectrum, you can get the frequency domain spectrum by Fourier transform. So this is a beautiful example of frequency time domain equivalent. So whatever is in your frequency spectrum is reflected in the dynamics, in the time domain dynamics of the system. That is very important principle. Okay, so now I've shown you a couple of examples of a pump probe spectroscopy, a nonlinear spectroscopy, wave packet motion, and electronic relaxation and vibrational relaxation. We have one more example of a nonlinear spectroscopy called second harmonic and some frequency generation. And this is a so this is a kind of a similar process to two photon absorption, but now instead of just system absorbing and then maybe relaxation and emission. This is a coherent process where two photons are combined to produce a third photon. And so you need material to drive this process, but we combine two photons and they produce a third photon, which is a sum of the two photons. So this is called second harmonic generation or sound frequency generation. Two photons with frequencies omega 1 and 2 and wave vectors k1 and k2. This is important. Wave vector means basically the direction of the beam. Wave vector is proportional to the momentum. So momentum is conserved, but the photons combine and they produce new photons with frequency sum of the two, a new wave vector as a k sum. And both energy and momentum must be conserved. And that's why we have this condition. So the frequency of the new photon is the sum over these, and the direction of the wave vector is sum over these. So if I put them like this, the new beam will go into this direction because it's a sum. So, and this happens in matter, but matter state doesn't change. It just facilitates this process. And this is, so this is proportional to the second order polarization, which is proportional to the chi2, so second order susceptibility times electric field to the second power. So this is, I pick one term which is responsible for this effect on the polarization, nonlinear polarization. Interestingly, if the driving field is monochromatic, then when we take the square, we get the result that we get the new frequency 2 omega, which is understandable. It should be 2 omega. So basically, it means that we induce new polarization with the twice the frequency of the original, and this is a second harmonic generator. So this is a practically technologically important effect where we can change the frequency of the laser light. If you take green laser pointer, this is most probably produced by neodymium YAG laser, which is frequency doubled with this technique. So you take a crystal, nonlinear crystal, shoot your 1064 nanometer light in, and you produce 532 nanometer with this technique. But it also can be used for spectroscopy. For example, second harmonic generation vanishes in centrosymmetric media due to symmetry. So if you put it in the bulk in a centrosymmetric media, there is no generation of second harmonic generation. But at the interface, if you have an interface of this material, symmetry is broken and you generate second harmonic generation at the interface. So this becomes very sensitive technique for example, surface spectroscopy. Now, I didn't tell you the whole truth about the momentum, because we have to remember that momentum actually, or the wave vector is magnitude is proportional to the dielectric constant n. So that has to be taken into account. And now when these two beams propagate and they generate a second beam, or second photon with the twice the frequency or some frequency, because the dielectric constant depends on frequency, then what happens is that quite soon the generated wave and the two original waves go out of phase. And if they go out of phase, this leads to destructive interference. So it doesn't happen anymore. But so what has to be done is we would have to have propagation in a medium where the refractive indices for the two different frequencies would be the same. And that can be, so this is the out of phase condition. So when we have a fundamental wave and it generates new waves at different parts, as soon they go out of phase, these generated waves, and they get attenuated. But we can have crystals which are birefringent, which means that the dielectric constant or refractive index is different for different directions. So if we use certain direction of the crystal, we can match the refractive indices for the two beams, and then we can have a very efficient generation of the second harmonic wave. And that's why when we do this kind of second harmonic generation in a crystal, we tune the crystal angle to optimize the efficiency. That is the practical way of doing it. Okay, this is the intensity of second harmonic wave is proportional to this expression here, where we have the delta k is the wave vector mismatch. So basically, we have to match these wave vectors, and when we do that, we get the efficient generation, which is proportional to the square of the intensity and square of the length. Okay, now this shows how the sum frequency technique can be used for as a spectroscopic tool. So some frequency is the same as for second harmonic, but just with two different original frequencies. So here, for example, I put in to the to my sample omega 1 and omega 2. So they are different frequency. And then they generate some frequency. And now you see that if I have some real state B, the first transition omega 1 in this picture is resonant with that. And because it's resonant, this becomes very strong. So now what we can do is that we fix omega 2 and we tune omega 1. And if we and observe the sum frequency. And if omega 1, when it hits this resonance, we get very strong generation. So in this way, we can map these states. So it becomes a spectroscopic technique. So that shows you, this is a nonlinear spectroscopy. We have two photon interactions generating third photon. And this is an example of how we can do spectroscopy with nonlinear effects. I show one more four-way mixing because this is what we do here in Nanoscience Center. This is a free photon interaction. So this is how it's done in practice. Here is a sample. We take three laser beams, three pulse laser beams, E1, E2, E3, and we mix them. So it's free photon interaction. And this is already quite interesting case because we can have many different interactions. We can have omega 1 plus omega 2 plus omega 3. Or we can have omega 1 plus omega 2 minus omega 3, omega 1 minus omega 2 plus omega 3, and so on. So it generates multiple interactions, multiple beams. But we can pick one of them, which is the red, the blue is the generated new beam due to wave mixing. And you can see that we can choose the directions of the beam so that this is comes to different direction than the other. So we can easily separate this beam from the other. And this is in fact, it's a coherent beam. It's not like fluorescence, which goes to all directions, but it is has the same propagation properties as the input beam. So that gives sensitivity to the technique. So we can collect all light from this beam. So here is one example of work we did with forming this technique. This is a phonon dynamics in graphene. So what we did is this, we have graphene, single layer graphene, and we use two first beams, omega 1 and omega 2, to drive phonon excitation. So we excite lattice vibration via Raman scattering. And these are overlapping time. Then we wait and come with the third pulse, and omega 4 is the emitted beam. And if I go back, they are here. So 1 and 2 goes to the sample. Then we wait, we come in with the third pulse, and we detect in this direction of the blue beam and observe the photon emitted there. And now the intensity decays when the phonon excitation relaxes or defaces out. So we can follow how it happens in time. And here up, we can see the how it goes. So the decay, so the first sharp peak is when all the beams are overlapped. That is when the multiple things happen. We cannot say what is happening. But after that, we have a decay of the phonon. So we can follow the how the phonon excitation in graphene relaxes in real time, and we observe 325 times per second decay time. Below here is the same thing now shown in a different way. So what we did here is that we delayed two delays, basically delay between omega one and omega two, and then omega two and omega three. And you can see that in the center, we have all the beams overlapping. So we have strong beam, strong signal, but then along tau probe, which is the delay between pulses two and three, we do see this decay, which is shown as a cross section up here. But for other directions, there is no such decay. So only we can only observe this phonon decay and not other processes, only excitation. So this is an example of how this kind of nonlinear spectroscopy can be used to investigate the relaxation dynamics of a monolayer graphene material. Yeah, so here are we have two four-way mixing setups. This is one of them, this is the older one. It looks very complicated, but PhD student can learn to work with it and make a thesis and working independently, no problem. But upstairs again, I show this arrangement how it is done. So we actually put three laser beams in a single large lens, and that lens bends these beams so that we get three beams coming at different directions. Then they continue propagation, but a new beam is generated, and we use a pinhole to separate it from others, so we get a nice signal beam. Here is a wave vector calculation. You can calculate into which direction it comes. And down here is the practical observation. So if I put screen here, this is what I see. This is a beautiful demonstration of multiple nonlinear processes. So the large spots are input beam. Then you can see the blue spots. You can see blue spots in between. And this blue spot between green and yellow is a sum frequency from green and yellow. So it comes to this direction, and it is blue, it is upconverted, it's a UV. This blue spot between green and red is a sum frequency of these two. And this third blue spot is sum frequency between them. So in the same experiment, we observe three sum frequencies. And then this spot down here in the center, this is the four-way mixing beam from all these three beams. It comes to this direction and has a different wavelength. And the blue spot to the left of that is a four-way mixing beam from these two beams, where we have two interactions, two photons come from this beam and one photon from this beam. On the right, the green spot, same thing. It's a four-way mixing with two photons from the yellow beam and one photon from the red beam. And you can see even the blue spot between this four-way mixing signal and the yellow spot, and that is the sum frequency from the four-way mixing photon and the yellow photon. So you see that when we have a lot of photons and they mix in all different waves, and we can see multiple species. In principle, we can detect and see all different possible processes. It turns out that some of them are more useful than others. And for example, this central lower spot is the spot which gives us information about dynamics, because we can delay omega 2 and omega 3 and observe how the signal decays. Thank you for staying 14 lectures of hard stuff. So we stop here. I realize there is a lot to chew, and certainly I don't expect anybody to master all this material, but hopefully something has sticked, and I hope this gives a good basis for further explorations in spectroscopy. But is there any questions or any comments at this point? Let's have. No?
The course was well organized, in my opinion.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, but you mean how it was done, like
lectures
and video and demo and everything? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Good to hear. Thanks. I think that I would like to maybe simplify this a bit. Maybe it's too much.
Yeah. It's a lot taking, but luckily there is two exams.
Yeah. Yes, and as you may have realized, although there has been quite many fairly complicated developments of theories, it's not something that is required from the at the test. So this may be, as I told, that most of these formulas, it's not the purpose that you would be able to kind of derive or handle or manipulate the formulas, but we try to pick from the derivations the key points for this. What everything depends on, so that is the idea here. But maybe a bit of. I think I would myself like to simplify a bit and more concentrate on the most important points. That is maybe something I will do. But otherwise, so you will have one more demo next week, and then the test. We have a test next week, and yeah. So if you have any questions or you something is unclear, or I guess many things are unclear, feel free to contact either me or Eero for help. Otherwise, I wish you happy Christmas.
And relaxing.
Also, none of those.